This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. The refugees fleeing civil war in Syria have made their way into Europe and now the U.S. The terrorist attacks in Paris have politicized the issue of refugee resettlement in a new way, though. Governors from many states in the U.S. have said they don't want to open doors to more people fleeing this country. In Connecticut, our governor has openly welcomed them. WNPR's Lucy Nalpathanchil recently spoke to a Syrian woman who's lived here for 15 years. Ghufran Al-Babdidi is a naturalized U.S. citizen who was born and raised in Syria. She says shutting out Syrian refugees is the wrong thing to do.
I mean, if we think about it, those civilians has nothing to do with any kind of terrorism. They are running from terrorism. They are the ones who are suffering, just like the people in Paris, from the violence. And many, many of Syrian people, they have been killed because of ISIS.
Today, Where We Live, we'll take a closer look at the ongoing debate over refugee resettlement and consider Connecticut's role in helping those displaced by conflict. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. We'd like to hear your voice on this. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We're going to talk with some town officials who have differing views on this issue coming up in a moment. But first, I want to welcome in our reporter, Lucy Nalpathanchil, who hosts Midday News here at WNPR. And she's also been covering this issue and many other issues having to do with immigrants and refugees in our state. Lucy, welcome back to the show.
Hi, John.
First of all, what is a refugee and what do we know about the process that brings them here?
Well, when you look at the definition of a refugee, it's someone who has been forced to leave their country, their home, because of persecution. It can be because of their race, their religion, their political opinion, their nationality. And we know in this country, historically, the U.S. started actually admitting refugees after World War II, many displaced Europeans. It wasn't until the mid-1970s after the Vietnam War, when the U.S. actually passed a law in 1980, but they saw this influx of Vietnamese and the need to help them. And so that's when they actually passed a law to govern refugee resettlement services in this country. Since that time, the mid-1970s, 3 million refugees have come to the United States.
So 3 million refugees have come to the United States. The numbers coming around the Syrian conflict so far, relatively small, but some people have come to Connecticut.
They're very small, actually. So since the civil war began in Syria, 4 million Syrians have been displaced. Since 2011, the U.S. has admitted about 2,500 Syrian refugees to this country. We know in Connecticut in the last year, more than 40 Syrians and their families have come into Connecticut. And again, when we look at the refugee crisis going on over in Syria, so when a Syrian is fleeing their country, they cross an international border. It'd be Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey. And it's the first agency that gives them that refugee status is the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. From there, they sit in a refugee camp. So they have three choices. They could stay in that country they fled to and decide that they're going to try to wait it out. Maybe they can go back to their home one day. They could sit in that refugee camp and decide, well, maybe this country that I fled to could be a place for me and my family. Or if you see the refugee crisis going on now in Syria and the thousands that are stuck in these camps, children, women, they want a better life for themselves. So they wait for a foreign government that will accept the refugee application. The UN only turns over a fraction of those refugee applications to foreign governments like the United States. So say that application now is in the hands of the State Department. The State Department oversees the refugee admissions program in this country. They then decide, does this person fit the refugee status? Again, someone fleeing persecution. If so, then that gets the ball rolling. Security in terms of screenings with the Department of Homeland Security, the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, and even U.S. Customs and Border Protection, all involved in the screening of an individual. That process doesn't take days. It doesn't take months. It takes years for a refugee to be allowed in this country. We're told by the federal officials anywhere from 2 to 4 years.
So the vetting process that we've heard so much about, what exactly does this entail? And is there any different vetting process that you've learned of regarding those fleeing this particular civil war than refugees that could have been coming from any other conflict around the world over the last 10 or 20 years?
So since the terrorist attacks in Paris, federal officials have had to come to reporters, come to local officials, including governors of states who don't want Syrians in their states, to explain the process. And so it begins with finding out, you know, why are they fleeing? Who do they associate with? Where have they traveled in the last several years? Biometric information that entails, like, where they've been, who they know. And again, this claim of anyone can say, well, I'm fleeing because I'm worried about persecution. My family's worried about their lives. But it's these officials and these agencies that are responsible for, you know, confirming that this is true. And that has been going on for several years. Even after 9/11, we have the whole new Department of Homeland Security doing that work.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266, as we talk about refugee resettlement and refugees coming to the United States and into Connecticut, I want to welcome back to our program Dr. Saud Anwar, who's a South Windsor Town Council member. He was Connecticut's first Muslim mayor, and he's joined us to talk about issues having to do with Muslim Americans in the past on the program. And I want to welcome you back to the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, John. Thank you for having me.
I'm wondering how the news strikes you of governors saying that they don't want to accept Syrian refugees. Some governors, like Connecticut Governor Dana Meloy, saying they want to welcome Syrian refugees. I'm wondering, as a Muslim American and someone who's followed this very closely, also someone involved in town politics, how this news has struck you.
So I think this issue has become very emotional, and as a result of which, people are responding in an emotional manner rather than actually in a rational, intellectual, data-based manner. And I think that's how I'd like to approach this as well. We really need to recognize that our country, United States, has one of the finest mechanism of going through the due diligence of getting the refugees into the country in the appropriate manner. And we have had very successful results. We are also the leader in the world, in the entire world. When we have a disaster of this capacity, which is actually one of the largest number of refugees that people have seen since World War II, it is important that we be the leader and continue to show the leadership. And I think when many governors in the other parts of the country show that they are actually going to make an emotional judgment rather than a rational judgment, it actually sends a message across the world that we as a country are not showing our leadership and our responsibility. And I think that's the concern that I have, and I'm thankful that our state is actually taking the true leadership in this matter.
I'm sure that you have some constituents, though, sir, who've come to you with some concerns about this. After the Paris attacks, there are concerns that any attempt to allow more people fleeing this terrible conflict may indeed allow people into our country who could cause harm to Americans. When people come to you with those concerns, what do you tell them?
Well, here's the reality. So we know that ISIS is the enemy of the region, of the world at this point. And if you look at the ISIS operatives that have been identified in the United States, actually the 68 or so people that have been captured, they actually 81% were U.S. citizens. Not a single person was from Syria or Syrian background. So, yes, there's a concern, but let's look at the probability and the realistic likelihood of that concern. And that's where we need to actually also recognize that this is also a moral war. They have zero morality, and we have significantly more morality, and we need to actually win the hearts and minds of everyone in the world by showing how compassionate and true humans we are.
I want to bring into the conversation Mark Boughton, who's the mayor of Danbury, Connecticut. He's been quoted as saying that everyone wants to be compassionate, but we've got to be smart here. The fact of the matter is we are at war with ISIS, and we know that could be a conduit, our letting people come into the country. Mark Boughton joins us by phone. Mayor, welcome back to the program. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, John, thanks for having me.
What are some of your concerns about the current vetting process, as it were, and the current process by which we welcome in refugees from abroad?
Well, I think there are a lot of different issues, as your speakers have already mentioned, relating to the confluence of a whole bunch of different events. But look, here's the way I sort of see the issue. One, we are absolutely at war with ISIS, and I think the president needs to say that we're at war with ISIS, and in a larger way, with radical Islamic terrorism, because we know ISIS is not the only purveyor of the kind of actions that we saw in France. And there's nothing wrong with saying that. We shouldn't hide from that. And I think it should be every American, regardless of their ethnicity, regardless of their religion's goal to wipe out this kind of behavior in the world. I think that, you know, taking in children and taking in widows and women, you know, with the proper vetting is absolutely appropriate and is part of the larger sort of value system that we have here in America. But I will tell you, for the life of me, I don't understand why we would be taking in any male 18 to 55 who, frankly, has no business being a refugee. You know, they should stay in Syria. They should fight ISIS, fight against the changes for change in their country, as generations have done in other countries throughout the years. Many people say, well, they're going with their families. But yet, at the same time, we're sending American men and women over to the Middle East, over to Syria in cases, to do their fighting for them. And we're tearing them away from their families. So I think that, you know, a safe zone that was to be set up in Syria for able-bodied men who would be willing to take up arms or do whatever needs to be done to help rid the world of this scourge would be, I think, helpful. But I think overall our responsibility, particularly to the children, is something that we should embrace. This is a thorny issue. And, you know, you asked about the vetting question. I'm going to get there in a minute. Here's a problem. The people in the United States of America have no faith in this government to be able to vet anything. I mean, we have a porous open border that there's no vetting. I mean, people literally will cross the border this afternoon and be anywhere in Connecticut by tonight without ever having a question asked of them. And that's part of the much larger global discussion about the kind of country that we have to be able to manage.
But I think
in the context of this war on terror that is sort of an ongoing thing for the last dozen years or so.
I think what you're asking about there, you're conflating perhaps the two things. One has to do with immigration, people who come to this country illegally from outside, versus a process by which people actually have to register with the State Department, where people really are vetted about as closely as the United States vets anybody to enter the United States. These are two very different things, aren't they, Mayor?
Well, I think that but they fit into a much larger global problem, because you're asking Americans to have faith that the vetting system is working. I personally think it is. I don't necessarily have an issue with it. But you're asking the American public to say, listen, we're going to vet these people, but yet, you know, people can point and say, well, we don't vet, you know, the guy down the street who just showed up yesterday. So I think there's a lack of faith that people have within the government that they can do what they say they're going to do. And I think that's part of the problem that the president has in saying this. Now, as far as governors go, I mean, look, let's be honest. I mean, they really don't have a say in this issue. I think one of your speakers was right that, you know, there's a certain amount of emotionalism and jingoism going on here in terms of being able to look tough on terror, and I think it's kind of silly. But you know, at the end of the day, I think our government has to be able to convince the Americans that they can, in fact, do what they say they're going to do.
Lucy?
I think just to the point of why Syrian men would want to flee their home country, I don't think any of us in this room would want an ISIS target on our backs when you see what that group has done to thousands of people in Syria and in Iraq. And something that I want to bring up later in the show but is important to stress in terms of the people that are fighting for our freedoms, this House bill would restrict Iraqis from coming to this country as refugees, the same Iraqis that have worked with the U.S. government and its allies during the war and after. There are programs set up for Iraqis who have worked for the U.S. government, the Special Immigrant Visa Program, the Direct Access Program, to help these people who, again, have targets on their back, more so now that ISIS has power in Iraq, and they are not able to come because they're stuck in this pipeline. This House bill also restricts these Iraqis.
I'm not going to defend the House bill, but look, there's no bigger target on the back than that of an American walking around the Middle East right now. So I think it's absurd to say, well, they're coming here because they have a target on the back, but it's okay to send American men and women, young people, the flower of our generation, over there to defend the very rights that these people are running from.
Dr. Anwar.
Yes, I just want to clarify something. When we talk about the term Islamic terrorism, we're actually giving credibility to these barbaric individuals. Their number one enemy in the world is Muslims. And if you look at what they're doing, these people are fleeing from these very terrorists. And that's the reality. They have murdered over 100,000 people in the last 2 years alone. And these are all Muslims that they have murdered.
Many Christians, too.
But
we're
just
not taking in any Christians.
But Mark, the reality is,
we've actually been Christians.
Mark, the reality is that just giving them more credibility by attaching a faith to it is actually giving them more power that they don't necessarily need. They don't need the credibility, and they actually are murderers of every faith, and proportionately, they have killed more Muslims than anyone else. And so rather than alienating a community, let's partner with community to take care of these evil people. I was going to say a stronger word, but I don't think evil people.
You can't think of a good enough word. No question about it. Yeah.
Well, I will ask you, Mayor Boughton, has your city, Danbury, have you welcomed in refugees from other countries in the past?
Oh, absolutely. And look, if somebody showed up from Syria tomorrow, we would be a welcoming community. There's no question about that. But this is a much larger global issue. I would add, though, that local. The interesting thing of all these decisions made by the president, the people that end up having to deal with a lot of these assimilation challenges are local elected officials, because once they're landed, there's very little support that's provided to these folks, which is in of itself a whole other story.
Well, one thing I did want to ask, Lucy, is you were laying out the process by which refugees come into the United States. You said that there are a number of agencies that provide these services, but these aren't necessarily U.S. government agencies, and these aren't necessarily even state government agencies. There are a lot of NGOs, nonprofits, mm-hmm. that do this work in the country. And so as we've been following this, it's a very diffuse system. It's very hard to get your hands around who's providing the services for people who come in under the cover of the State Department from elsewhere.
That's right. The State Department works closely with nine main resettlement agencies in the United States. Those resettlement agencies then work with partners in communities around the country, these smaller refugee resettlement agencies, churches, nonprofits in the community, to then find places for these refugees to be resettled and connect them with services like English classes, like health care, like education. So when we were asking the question of, can governors stop these refugees from being resettled in their state? Technically, it's the federal government that has that responsibility and has that oversight. But governors can make it harder for these services to then be connected to refugees. And so that's where the sticking point was. And we've heard from federal officials from last week and then also this week trying to allay those concerns that governors have about the people coming into their states.
Before I let you go, Mayor Boughton, I'm wondering specifically what you would have done differently than the process that we have currently. As you say, you're not supporting the House bill that was voted on, including by two Connecticut representatives.
Yeah, look, I just don't know enough about it. I'm not going to argue the merits of it back and forth.
But I guess I'm wondering what you think should change about the process that we have right now. You've said welcoming in women and children, not necessarily men of fighting age. What are some other changes to this process that you would propose?
Look, I think the other thing is I would put pressure on the countries that are surrounding Syria to do their fair share in terms of resettlement. The U.S. has 5% of the world's population. We take in 30% of the refugees from around the world. And I think it's important that places like Saudi Arabia and other countries that have a tremendous wealth at their fingertips ought to be a participant in helping solve this problem. We're not going to solve the U.S. and Europe is not going to solve this issue in the Middle East without strong partners from countries that surround Syria and be partnerships in shutting down these kinds of organizations. So it's important that we pressure them to do their fair share as it relates to the refugees as well. At the end of the day, the other thing I would do is shut down the visa program that allows these folks to move around freely, both in Europe and come to the U.S., currently enacted in Europe, and certainly that would need more review as well. But look, again, as I said at the outset of this, women and children are fine. We certainly should do our fair share in terms of helping them, assuming that they've all been properly vetted. But any able-bodied male should be placed in a safe zone in Syria.
Dr. Anwar?
Yeah, actually, with respect to the comment about the neighboring communities, with respect to the countries like Saudi Arabia and Qatar, I actually completely agree with Mark about that. But the neighboring countries, and I want to share some information, which is sad. The Turkish economy for the world from the GDP perspective is 1% of the world's GDP, and they have 50% of all the Syrian refugees. Lebanese economy is 0.06% of the world, and they have 25% of all the Syrian refugees. And Jordan economy is 0.04% of the world, and they have 15% of the refugees. The United States has 22% of the world's economy, and we have 0.04% of the refugees. And I think that's the neighboring communities are doing far more than their share. than anyone else.
I said the wealthy neighboring community.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I agree with you.
You can't ask Lebanon to take any more refugees. I agree with you.
Yeah.
But Saudi Arabia needs to step to the plate.
Yeah.
So does Qatar and other places.
Yeah.
Yeah, and one thing I think I'm fairly sure of, that we here in Connecticut are not going to solve the problem of what Saudi Arabia should and shouldn't do in terms of policy for the rest of the world. I want to thank Mark Boughton, the mayor of Danbury, Connecticut. Thank you so much, sir. I appreciate it.
Thanks, John.
We're going to continue this conversation, including taking some of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. When you hear about the Syrian refugee crisis, would you like to see Connecticut welcome more refugees from this war-torn country? Give us a call, or you can tweet us at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about refugees in Connecticut, especially surrounding the Syrian refugee crisis. We're joined by Lucy Nalpathanchil, WNPR's reporter, who's been covering this issue for us. And also in studio with us is Dr. Saud Anwar, who's a South Windsor town council member. He was Connecticut's first Muslim mayor. Joining us by phone now is Noor Alfaris, who is a Syrian refugee in Connecticut, a medical case manager at Catholic Charities. And Noor, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning for you all. Thank you so much for having me.
Maybe you could tell us a bit of your story. When did you come to the United States?
I came to the United States by the end of 2010. I came alone. My husband was staying in Syria at that point because he couldn't leave his business. But then after the revolution started and everything was going so crazy, so he followed me. Almost like the middle of 2011.
What was the process like for you to get here? Maybe you can explain a little bit for us what you went through to come from Syria to the United States first. We talked a bit about the process that has been much discussed in the United States over the course of the last couple of weeks, but maybe you can describe it in your words, in your story.
So I came through visiting visa. My mom was here. She was having treatment. She was battling cancer. I came here to see her, visit her. Her health condition was going so bad. I wasn't thinking, honestly, I wasn't thinking to come and stay here because I was having my whole life there and it wasn't that bad. But then after everything started and then the law enforcement in Syria was following my husband because he participated in the revolution, he came here. So then our journey started to seek asylum because on visa status, you don't have the right to work. And, you know, without working, we can't support our family. And that's so important. If we want to start a new life, we have to work and be part of the community. So we started looking for lawyers. At the beginning, I came to New York. We started looking for lawyers, and we did not get so much good feedbacks. They said some lawyers told us that there's nothing such an asylum, and you're not going to get any support or any help until we find someone here in Connecticut who was able to help us have connection with the University of Hartford Asylum Clinic, and they sponsor us, and they take care of the case, and we were granted for asylum in 2012.
So now, a few years later, as you see what's going on in Syria and certainly with people fleeing that country, what is your reaction to the debate that we've been having on this program so far and that you've been hearing on the news over the course of the last several months?
I mean, of course, I have some concerns about the reactions of, you know, blaming a whole religion or a whole country for what some criminals did. But at the same time, I understand what's the fear is coming from, because I know how does it feel to, you know, feel unsafe or if you feel threat from anything. But at the same time, I think most of the people don't know what the refugees go through, how many screaming, how many, you know, how many organizations are involved in their resettlements. And in order to come here, it takes them years for security check and, you know, health screening and all type of screening. So I think that's why they are a little bit concerned, because I don't think most people know the process for refugees to come here.
Nora, can you talk a little bit more about the questions that you and your husband were asked when you wanted to come here on an asylum?
We were told to tell our story, you know, everything happened with us, all the details, you know, what was our reaction to the law enforcement action with my husband, you know, his, the way he was arrested, everything happened with him, the fact that I've lost my house was burned, and then the whole building was destroyed. You know, we've lost some of our family members. We needed to clarify all of this. You know, we've been we have been asked, you know, have my husband joined the army before, or did he fight with any side before? They were so specific. They wanted to know everything. They wanted to know why we want to stay here. What's, you know, what's our plan? They wanted to know everything, and we were, you know, honest and open about everything. And it worked for, I think, for both sides.
I want to invite you to call 860-275-7266 if you want to join our conversation. Scott is calling from Hartford. Scott, go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Thanks, John. You know, I read a comment by the head of the Syrian community in New York who said recently that because everyone is so desperate for money in Syria that you can get official documents, not fake documents, official, to say basically that you're a giant caterpillar and they will put it on those documents. And so, you know, ISIS is filtering people through refugees into Europe. It's safe to assume that they're going to do the same thing here. They're going to try and filter in ISIS operatives through the refugee program. And if you don't have access to the criminal databases in Syria, how are you going to ever vet them?
One of the things, Scott, and I appreciate your phone call. I just want to ask you a question. One of the things that we've heard from an awful lot of people who support the current policy of inviting in refugees is that when you talk about intelligence, there's no better human intelligence than actually welcoming in people who've just been in a war zone and who know who's fighting whom and who might know the individuals who could be the most dangerous. To a certain extent, wouldn't it make sense to welcome in people who would be able to tell you who exactly we should be concerned about? These are people who are fleeing a really terrible situation. They'd probably be more willing to help the United States government than just about anybody else.
All I'm saying, John, is that you don't know who that person is. If it's an ISIS operative, they could say that you're not going to know who they are. And it only takes a handful of people, as we saw in Paris, to pull off a terrible attack.
So
if you have a failure rate of just a few people and they come in and they pull a Paris-style attack here, would you say the refugee program was worth it?
Can I just ask you one more question, if you don't mind? Some of the individuals who've been involved in terrorist attacks have actually been residents of European countries. And the United States has a visa waiver program, an ability to very easily travel between the U.S. and Europe back and forth. Certainly, many of those the people who have residency in, say, France or Belgium have last names that might tag them as someone coming from another country, but they're French citizens or Belgian citizens. I guess I'm wondering if you believe that we should limit somehow people traveling back and forth from Europe to the United States under the U.S. visa waiver program.
I don't know. The question was about bringing Syrian refugees to this country, so I don't know enough to answer the question.
Scott, I really appreciate your phone call. Dr. Anwar?
Sure. I think Scott brings an important point that during every time there's an unrest in any society, there are things that can happen, and fake information, fake documents are something that are common phenomena. Whatever we are seeing or hearing about in Syria right now is something that has happened in all conflicts. I mean, these are human phenomena that are happening across every conflict. And I think I trust our law enforcement agencies when they do their due diligence, because this is no news or no new information, and they actually go through this vetting process, which is an obsessively detailed one. It does not take about a few days, few weeks. It takes about a few years to be able to do this. So these individuals get cross-checked at so many levels that I do feel that this concern, while there, is well managed by our law enforcement agencies who are well informed about this process.
Just to get to the really the heart of, I think, something Scott was getting at, though, whether or not it's through refugee resettlement or some other means, there are concerns by many Americans that what has happened across Europe may happen here in that the radicalization of certain individuals within a community might take root. This causes an awful lot of problems as far as people targeting all Muslims as being terrorists. But I think to Scott and many other people, we might want to say, well, we're taking all the possible precautions to make sure we know everything about radicals of all stripes in the United States. Can you just talk more about that? I know that we've discussed this on past programs having to do with how Americans view Muslims, but I think it's an important thing to talk about here.
Right. And John, a few years ago, I was a part of a program with the U.S. government and the British government to actually go from United States to interact with the various communities in England. And the purpose was to try and look at the American experience of the Muslims and look at the experience in part of Europe. And then we actually had a meeting in Brussels as well on the same topic to look at what's the difference. The reality is that we are so blessed in America that every American is a hyphenated American. And it's a country which accepts everyone, and people integrate and assimilate into the society far more than anything in Europe. So you would see people of 3-4 generations out, but they would still call themselves as a part of another part of the world where their forefathers came from. They would not call themselves British, even though they had British passports. The reason was twofold. The community was not integrating, and the larger society was not willing to allow them to get integrated. So this these silos of people living in these, if almost ghettoized situation, is part of the problem in Europe. On the other hand, in the United States, we actually have a different set of group of people who have immigrated, who are part of the society, and they actually are contributors and believe deeply, like anyone else, that they are part of the society. We are Italian Americans, Brazilian Americans, Pakistani Americans, Indian Americans, so Muslim Americans, Jewish Americans. We are all hyphenated, but we are part of the American experience. And that's why we have this resiliency buildup in our heritage.
And do you think that there's something to this notion that if you welcome in refugees from a place that there's a terrible civil war happening, you might indeed gain a bit more knowledge about those individuals who could cause us harm? You might know a little bit more about some of the problems, the issues, the persons indeed who cause problems, so we might better have intelligence, information.
Absolutely. And I think that's what we miss in this whole picture is the human intelligence element. And that is the weakness that we have had all along. We need human intelligence on ground here with respect to protect the larger society. We need human intelligence in Syria to know who is the right person to support because, frankly, United States has been very weak with respect to who they're supporting or not supporting because we are attacking Assad, but Assad is also fighting ISIS. So it's like a confused picture with respect to our policy at times.
Noor, before I let you go, I guess I'm wondering if you could just give me some reaction to what you have seen happening in Syria and whether or not you're in contact with family members or others there.
Of course, it's not easy to see what's going on in Syria every day. Every morning I wake up and I prepare myself to hear bad news about someone that I love or a friend or a family member. Connection is sometimes possible, sometimes it's hard because even inside Syria, people are dislocated. So people are, forced to move to another cities. Sometimes there's no internet connection, no electric to charge phones or get access to any, communication tools. I've lost some family members, and it's really hard to see that. But what I did is I'm trying to take care of myself and my family by feel how much I'm blessed to be safe from that situation. I have 3 little girls, and I'm really grateful to the second chance they have, because if we were still in Syria, I don't know what would happen to them. But here they go to school, you know, and they are doing a great job in school and they are growing every day.
Noor Al-Faris is a Syrian refugee who lives in Connecticut. She's a medical case manager at Catholic Charities, and she joined us by phone. Noor, thank you so much for sharing your story, and I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
When we come back from our break, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Saud Anwar and Lucy Nalpathanchil of WNPR, and welcome in more guests as well as some of your thoughts at 860-275-7266 as we talk about the Syrian refugee crisis and what it means right here in Connecticut on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, will state lawmakers have a budget deal in place to be thankful for? Our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse, will bring you updates from the state capitol where time ticks away for an agreement on the state budget. We'll also talk about how two members of Connecticut's congressional delegation broke with colleagues on the refugee vote. That's tomorrow's Where We Live. Join us in The Wheelhouse. Today, we're talking about that refugee vote and more issues surrounding the refugee crisis. People fleeing Syria throughout Europe and into the United States. And we're joined today by Lucy Nalpathanchil, WNPR's reporter who's been covering this for us. Also, Dr. Saud Anwar is here. He's a South Windsor Town Council member. He was Connecticut's first Muslim mayor. Joining us in studio now is Monji Daoudi, who is executive director of the Connecticut chapter of the Council of American Islamic Relations. And, sir, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like you to talk a bit about some of the grassroots efforts that you've been involved in, including the 10 in 10 campaign that was launched by your organization. Tell us what you're trying to do.
First of all, I'm honored to be in this conversation, which is a great conversation to be had. You know, a couple months ago when we started seeing the images of Syrian refugees, especially the little boys and women and children who are washed ashore, fleeing the war-torn zone of Syria, fleeing the Bashar al-Assad regime's death machine, and the terror groups, including and especially ISIS. A lot of people wanted to do something. People started messaging each other, talking about, you know, they can't watch the news anymore. And so what we did, as we always do at the Council on American Islamic Relations, is we called in people and we said, you know, let's get together and see what we can do. And sure enough, within 2 days, we had more than 70 people who gathered at the Berlin Mosque, which is a great place for a lot of the interfaith groups and friends to gather and talk about these issues. And we came up with a plan. We said, what are the things that we can do, practically speaking, from here, from Connecticut, as residents of conscience, you know, people who care about the world. So we came up with issues to advocate for more Syrian refugees to come to the United States. So we set up meetings with our elected officials, including Senator Blumenthal and Senator Murphy. We talked to the office of Congressman Joe Courtney, who supported this effort. We talked to Congressman Himes, who we met with him personally, and he actually said that the 10 in 10 program will bring in maybe 400, 500 people. He said Connecticut should take more. We should take at least 2,000 people. So when we saw the vote, we were shocked, to tell you the truth. And but we're going to continue to talk to these folks. They are our representatives, and we're going to talk to them. On the grassroots level, about Connecticut, we came up with this campaign, which is 10 families in each city. We picked 10 cities. And we said, let's try. I mean, this is not a written in stone. It's just a goal so for us to drive and to galvanize people around. And the effort is still going on. Over this weekend, we had three churches in the old Lyme town who met. There was more than 90 people who showed up. No opposition to talk about. Some people are anxious because of the rhetoric and the fear that is being spread. But most of the people are committed to this program. They want to bring people. Of course, we are not experts in bringing in to resettle refugee families. So we contacted IRIS, we contacted Catholic Charities, we met with them, we talked to them about this program. And we said, look, you're the experts, you bring the families in here. We're going to provide you with a network of support. And we try to take politics out of this. Mm. We said, you know, let's hear the other side. What are their concerns? Number one, well, if they come here, they're not going to be able to find jobs. That means they're going to be dependent on the system. So we reached out to businesses and we said, look, how can you help in this effort? So we have several businesses who committed saying, if there's a Syrian refugee family that come here, we will provide you at least one person in that family with a job. We reached out to churches. We reached out to Board of Education and we said, look, you know, when we bring Syrian refugees here, some of these kids are going to need help in schools. So we provided with volunteers who speak Arabic and English. We said, look, we're going to put them at your disposal, free of charge. If you need help in the classroom, if teachers need help, these volunteers will help you. Mm-hmm. We have people who volunteer to drive these families around to medical appointments, to the grocery store, to the mall. We have construction company owners and said, look, if there is an abandoned building, whatever it is, Norwich, New London, Waterbury, we will go in, remodel, refurbish this place. We have a hotel owner who said, I'll give you the furniture. And so we'll provide that family with a place to stay for 2-3 years, and then we'll turn it back into the town. So this is a truly grassroots effort, and we're not saying to the government, we're going to just bring the refugees and you're going to take care of them. We're going to say, we're going to deal with this issue as a community.
And in a moment, we're going to be talking about another grassroots effort that's happening in Middletown. But Lucy?
And just quickly to clarify, I mean, part of the agreement when refugees come into the United States, you know, they do get a housing stipend for 3 to 4 months, but they are required, you know, to learn English, to get a job in 3 to 4 months. I mean, it's not a free ride when refugees come, so that's why it's equally important to have communities that come together to provide resources for these families, because after 3 months, you know, they're going to need it.
Absolutely. And to tell you the truth, I was surprised, and most of us, when we met with Iris and they told us, actually, the refugee, when they come here and they settle down, they will be also handed in an invoice that they have to pay the fare that brought them in here.
That's
they
right,
have
the
to
plane
pay
ticket.
Plane ticket. And so there is no free ride.
I want to welcome in Reverend Julia Berkey, who's a minister at First Church in Middletown, a United Church of Christ, to talk about another grassroots effort. And Reverend Berkey, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
I'm wondering if you can tell us what you're doing in Middletown.
Sure. So a couple of months ago, a few other faith leaders and myself got together, and in response to the refugee crisis, we wanted to see if we could welcome some refugee families to Middletown. And we also hooked up with IRIS in New Haven. They're the Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services. And they have a really succinct way to do this. You raise $3,000 per family. You set them up with housing and with potential employment. And so they have a system for doing this. And we decided after meeting with them a couple months ago, we've had a few different community coalition meetings that have involved probably 10 different faith groups and other organizations in Middletown, like Wesleyan, the local branch of the NAACP, and a couple other people from Middletown. We noticed that we had the tangible things to do through IRIS, the raise money, get furniture, get apartments, get employment. But we also wanted to do more of an education campaign in Middletown. And there's an organization called Connecticut Council for Inner Religious Understanding, and they host something called Honest Conversations with Muslim Neighbors. And so we are hoping to bring them to Middletown as well. But right now where we are, it's just been building. And there's been a lot of interest, especially from the faith organizations, because welcoming the stranger is really an act of faith. And when we're all honest about it, we all have been strangers and have come to this country from different areas. And during our last meeting with different community leaders in town, we all set our name, set our role in the community and organization, and then we named our ethnic or cultural background and the languages that we speak, just to kind of locate ourselves in this issue, so we don't other the refugees who are coming to Middletown.
And Manji, I think that this conversation, this is one that I've had with Dr. Anwar a number of times over the years. This conversation about bringing in religious leaders is so important, because religious leaders of all faiths tend to side on a few very key things, and one of them is compassion for outsiders, compassion for those who are less fortunate. And I think that having that conversation is a big part of making people understand a bit more of what you're trying to do.
Absolutely. And you know, us meeting at the Islamic Center of Greater Hartford in Berlin was a symbolic meeting and a place for us to come together. A lot of the faith leaders that came together. Also, after that meeting, my first group that I contacted and went to talk to is the New London Clergy Association. I went to them. This is the faith leaders that get together once a month. And I put forward this plan for them, and it was received by overwhelming support. So faith leaders have an important role to play, and I think the and I agree with our the speaker who is talking right now is that education component is extremely important. And one of the things that, we're planning to do coming weeks is that to put forward put a face to this you know, refugee numbers that we're talking about. I met with a lot of the Syrian communities in the New London area. It was about 30 of them that came. Many of them came through different venues, some of them been here for a long time, professionals, teachers, others, they were born and raised here. And I said, look, we need to get out and meet people. You need to go and talk to these people, especially those who are raising this question of fear and security issues. Let them meet you. Let them talk to you. Let them see that you've been their doctor, you've been their teacher, you've been their, you know, coworker, you've been their, you know, student in the classroom, and let them talk to you about your fears, about your anxiety. And I think this is a great conversation to have if we ever going to be able to win this war on terror, this war on ISIS and Al-Qaeda and all these groups. We need to galvanize and bring people together, not divide us.
So, and what does that conversation, Dr. Anwar, look like? Because we tend to have them, including on this radio program, in times of crisis, right? We don't have this conversation when things are rosy and we're just looking at our Pakistani doctor and saying what a nice guy he is. We tend to have this conversation when things are looking bleak. How do you propose we have a better conversation?
So this should be around the towns, and I think that's slowly, gradually happening. The leadership within the towns, within the communities, they need to have interactions. People need to step outside their comfort zones during non-crisis times to interact with each other, recognize each other and get to know each other as humans. And I think that's what is critical. In our town of South Windsor, we actually are fortunate to have interactions with the communities. Yesterday, we had a beautiful dinner at one of the synagogues to have celebration of the Thanksgiving and pray together with all the faith communities coming together. We have similar activities which bring us and humanize each other and stand up for each other's issues which come up.
I know, Lucy, in just the last moment or so that we have, you've been covering the story, of course, that got an awful lot of coverage, that Connecticut took in a family that was essentially going to go to Indiana. Can you just give us an update on where we are with that story?
So we know that they were headed to Indiana, but because the Indiana governor did not want them in his state, they were diverted to Connecticut. I spoke with Chris George from IRIS in New Haven, who helped find him and his staff helped find them temporary housing in a very short time frame. What was interesting about last week, there was so much attention on this family of three from Syria. At IRIS, they were also working to resettle five other families from Eritrea, Sudan, Iraq, Syria. There's another family of five from Syria that were also coming that week, and they were able to, you know, lean on the community to find a place for this family of three. And as Chris George mentioned, now they're going to try to get the five-year-old in school, help the parents find a job. I mean, that's now – it's the nonprofits, the private sector that's doing the work on the ground to help assimilate these people in these communities.
And those nonprofits are really the organizations, as we've said before, that we're leaning on here. And do you think that we just have 30 seconds or so, but that the nonprofits that you've been dealing with, sir, actually have the means necessary to do some of the work that we're hoping to do?
Well, that's our organization. What we're trying to do is provide them with the needed support. They need help. They need support. And I think our community needs to really have a true conversation in schools, in churches, in the mall, about how we can help our society come together in this time of need.
Manji Dawoodi is Executive Director of the Connecticut Chapter of the Council of American Islamic Relations. Thank you so much for coming in, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks to Reverend Julia Berkey, who's a minister at First Church in Middletown. It's United Church of Christ. And Reverend, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks to Dr. Saud Anwar, who is a South Windsor Town Council member. He was Connecticut's first Muslim mayor. Always good to talk with you, sir.
Thank you.
And Lucy Nalpathanchil, WNPR's host and reporter, who's been covering this issue for us. Thank you so much, Lucy.
Thank you, John.
A few emails we've gotten. The profile, this comes from Matthew, the profile most people use to understand who terrorists are is wrong. Something like 6 of the 9 Paris attackers were native-born Europeans. These weren't refugees. They were the kids of refugees. Tweet from Howard, it's silly to think that terrorists would rather submit to 2 years of screening when visitor and student visas are easier. There's a lot of tweets coming in at Where We Live. You can continue this conversation there and also online at wnpr.org/Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky, and thanks for joining us.